Greetings, friends. This is John Haspel, and I am the Dhamma teacher at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. The podcast will begin in a moment. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for additional podcasts, Dhamma articles, and a calendar of our weekly classes and monthly and yearly retreats. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you find this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you, and enjoy the talk.
So the Eightfold Path is the path that the Buddha gave us to experience the cessation of dukkha. Again, I read that how the Buddha described his path, and that it's just focused on one thing. The importance of that is to not try to make everything fit into the Dhamma. It doesn't have to. You know, we don't have to reconcile the Dhamma with anything else. We can enter into the Eightfold Path with just the stated intention to put aside dukkha. We don't have to expect the Dhamma, the Buddha's Dhamma anyway, to give us anything but that. And if we keep it that simple, I mean, the reason why I'm saying this is it's very important, because we tend to want something that we're going to devote this much attention to solve every issue we have and answer every question, you know? Like, what do the moons look like behind Pluto? Well, the Buddha said he knew that, but he said, don't worry about it. Stick to the Dhamma, you know? If we insist that we gain some kind of esoteric or special knowledge before the Dhamma is effective for us, it never will be, you know? It's a very simple practice. It's designed to recognize and put aside all the causes of dukkha. So the Eightfold Path begins with that view, with a right view. This is what I'm looking for. This is what I expect, is an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And then the intention to put aside everything that's blocking us from that, meaning all clinging, becoming empty of clinging. We've talked about right speech, action, and livelihood. There's a moral and ethical aspect of the Eightfold Path, that if we hope to bring the path to its conclusion, to the experience of the cessation of dukkha, we must do those things, and not in a way that we're going to burn in hell, or that somebody else or some other supreme or not so supreme being is going to judge us if we don't engage in right speech, action, or livelihood. The Dhamma practice simply won't work, you know? And it's a process of integrating those aspects into our lives, of understanding it. The questions last night about what is right speech are so important, because we need to integrate it first on a very gross level. You know, we stop lying, we stop screaming at people and that type of thing. But then we realize how subtle right speech is, and right action, and right livelihood. How important, and this is where mindfulness comes in, that we'll talk about in a later talk, to be mindful at a very subtle level of the things that we're doing, of our thoughts, of our actions with other people. Then the Buddha taught us right effort. In other words, if we're going to develop a Dhamma practice, we have to put in effort that's known as right effort, not wrong effort. And so that wrong effort could be getting into some other practices that are contrary to developing an understanding, and I won't get into the list of that. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't do other things. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage in yoga, certainly not Qigong. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't have an exercise program. We should. You know, it doesn't mean we shouldn't walk or run. Or any of those other things. But it does mean, as far as the Dhamma is concerned, there's a right effort involved. And that means to organize our lives for practice, to have a sitting practice, and also to have time to develop an understanding of the written Dhamma. You know, I'm not saying that you should all go and get a copy of the Pali Canon and try to understand that, but put your focus on understandings that are developed out of the Pali Canon. It's right effort, right? Mindfulness is a correct type of mindfulness that's focused on developing an understanding of the Eightfold Path. Again, the Buddha wasn't concerned. We'll talk about what the Satipatthana Sutta teaches and what it doesn't teach. And then with all of that as part of our foundation, we engage in a Shamatha Vipassana practice, right meditation. And so the purpose of that Shamatha Vipassana is to support the other seven factors. The other seven factors support what we're doing on our cushion. And all of that takes place in the environment of anicca. Suffering arises in anicca, in impermanence. Another aspect of impermanence is uncertainty. None of us know what the next moment is going to bring. I may awaken in the next moment and poof, I'll be gone. I'll still be sitting here. I'll still be flapping my gums. It's my nature to do that. The ignorance of not understanding the true nature of reality occurs in anicca, in impermanence, and awakening occurs in impermanence, right here where we're at. We don't go anyplace else. We awaken, and the reason why that's significant, we awaken in the phenomenal world where everything else is occurring, where all the distractions related to impermanence and uncertainty occur. It's within all of that that our minds settle and we see what's really here. That we lose attachment to all of those things that are grabbing our attention in this present moment. Because of impermanence, dukkha arises. If it wasn't for impermanence, there'd be no dukkha because nothing would ever change. We wouldn't be holding on to anything. We would just, I don't know what that would be. But it's because of the ever-changing nature of the world that we hold on to things, or we're concerned about what's coming down the pike, and we worry about it. And the more we worry, the more we get anxious, and that rises to the level of disease. Another aspect of craving is another disease called compulsion or addiction. And these are extreme examples arising out of that word that Maura doesn't like, clinging. And clinging occurs in impermanence. Emptying ourselves of clinging occurs in impermanence, in anicca. What experiences that, and this is going to be tonight's talk too, I think, on exactly what non-self is. What experiences that is what the Buddha said is non-self or not-self. And that's greatly misunderstood, too. When you hear the term non-self, immediately our minds will go, what the Buddha's talking about is there's no such thing. There's nothing there. And some beliefs go that way. The Buddha never said that. What he means by non-self or not-self is that what you think you are is not it. And it's just that simple. And it's not it because what you think you are is stuck in that impermanent view. It's something that's beyond that or before that, before we start making these distinctions between me and the rest of the world, between it making distinctions of who I want to be and what I don't want to be. It's all part of that not-self or non-self. And again, we'll talk more tonight about dependent origination and the skandhas, which are, the skandhas are the same groups that we cling to that I mentioned this morning, the Buddha talked about in that one paragraph of awakening, clinging to those groups, body, feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness, that those are the five clinging aggregates. The Buddha talked about it in two separate, or two distinct ways. In the environment of impermanence, a non-self, a thing that is a fabrication of our own decisions and associations and attachment, experiences dukkha. The unraveling or the unbinding occurs when we recognize this is what I created out of nothing, really. The saying is out of whole cloth. There's nothing substantial or permanent about what we've decided we are, but that doesn't mean nothingness. And to make the point again on impermanence, we exist as an ego personality within that ever-changing environment. The other significance of that, because it's ever-changing, our views of self can change. So any questions on that? They're pretty simple concepts, I think. Right? We all got impermanence. We all understand dukkha. We all understand that the views that we hold of ourselves is not who we are. That's the teaching on not-self. That's key. Doesn't mean that there's nothing here. The Buddha understood and put aside his ego personality. This is his awakening. And lived as a very effective human being for 45 years. Till it was time to go. That's what the Buddha wants us to understand. He wants us to be fully awakened human beings. Not something that does something else. Impermanence is an essential concept of the Dhamma. Impermanence describes the environment in which unhappiness and stress arises and is maintained. All things in the phenomenal world are uncertain, are impermanent, and all events are uncertain as to occurrence, effect, and duration. Even the view of self changes from moment to moment. So who we perceive ourselves to be changes moment to moment. When I was 3 years old, I had a perception of myself that's vastly different than who I am today. Yet there's a continuation there, isn't there? There's something that goes from one moment to the next moment to the next moment. I'll talk a little bit more about this Saturday night, but I'll mention it now. That's the essential teaching on rebirth. It's not so much dying and what happens after. It's that because of our perceptions and because of the effects of karma, each moment we're reborning ourselves into whatever we are. And because of held belief and conditioned thinking, we tend to have the same experience. Most of our perceptions of the world are set in place by the time we're 10 or 12 years old. And then we spend the rest of our lives reinforcing and defending that. Impermanent stress and the non-self are the three linked characteristics of life in the phenomenal world. Understanding these three concepts is developed within the framework of the Eightfold Path. The third essential concept of the Dhamma is the ego personality or non-self. What is perceived as a self is an ego personality that has arisen from certain conditions known as the 12 links of dependent co-arising. And I'll talk about that tonight. The ego personality is the form arisen from wrong view and maintained by clinging to wrong views. It takes a lot of wrong effort to keep this thing going. And don't take that wrong effort as a judgment. It just means that it's not in accordance with awakening. Non-self has been misinterpreted to mean that the self is nothing or a void and has led some to seek an experience of nothingness. Non-self simply means that what is commonly viewed as self is impermanent and insubstantial. This is a wrong view arising from ignorance. Non-self is an impermanent and insubstantial view that must be abandoned. In other words, who we think we are, every idea that we've decided this is what we are, is looked at, it arises, and we abandon it because we recognize it as impermanent, we recognize it as part of clinging. In a very real way, we're shedding who we think we are that is prone to suffering. Joy.
John, may I ask you to reread that passage that you just read?
About non-self?
Please.
Thank you for asking. Non-self has been misinterpreted to mean that the self is nothing or a void and has led some to seek an experience of nothingness.
And then?
Non-self simply means that what is commonly viewed as self is impermanent and insubstantial. This is a wrong view arising from ignorance.
For the first time I'm starting to understand this. Non-self. The concept of non-self means that this idea I have about what Joy Herzog is impermanent and insubstantial. And by locking into my idea of who I am, it reinforces all of those false ideas that went into this concept in the first place. So non-self, understanding and accepting non-self is understanding and accepting the transient, impermanent nature of my personhood, just like this breeze is blowing past my skin, that this is the idea of who I am, and that's the connection to the clinging. Do I understand that properly?
Exactly.
And then I'm open to be who I'm intended to be in this moment and let it go, in this moment and let it go.
Whatever that view is, it arises. That is, you can go.
Well, but I'd rather stay.
Please stay. Before I talk a little bit more about what you just said, this is how I would love this talk to go. I'll read a little bit, and if something gets your interest or you want some clarity or you want to comment on it, please raise your hand or throw a shoe at me. Because this is really what's important. It's not so much that I read these words. You know, I don't care if I get through this chapter this afternoon. But that if you have any confusion about what I'm saying, stop me and let's talk about it. So you mentioned it's like the breeze. The Buddha said it in one, I can't remember what sutta is, that the self is like the foam on the ocean. You know, it's just that there's nothing there to hold on to. He's not talking about nothingness. He's using that, the analogy of foam, of why hold on to it? It's the cause of all our suffering. And that's not in a negative way. It's just pointing out, it's getting to the root of it. What you're holding on to is what hurts. It's what creating all the confusion in your, it's what causing all the troubles in the world. From the individual ignorance gives rise to people flying planes into the World Trade Center. I think I brought this up last year too. It's an extreme example of individual ignorance combining with other conditioned thinking and where it ends up. Within an interpersonal relationship, it happens all the time. We become competitive and aggressive. You know, we all have, you know, and we're not, the best way to look at that is not, we're not bad people. We just don't understand who we are because we have such a strong connection and the need to defend this that has arisen from nothing. And we'll talk about how that happens tonight. That's the teachings on dependent origination. What are you holding on to? What are you defending? I know it's scary too when we come up against that. Because most of us spend our whole life, even if in a very subtle, almost subconscious way, defending who we think we are. We almost think we have to survive. Mm-hmm. The paradox is that we don't really begin to live our lives until we let go of who we think we are. And there's a process to it, Maura.
I was going to say, well, ignorance, you know, is a condition that the mind can't see what it can't see unless you experience it on a moment-to-moment basis. Perhaps. I don't know how clear that is. But it's not like we can help. I mean, that's the nature of life. We come in, we start with these clinging, and so we can let go of it, but it's in a moment-to-moment thing. It's not an intellectual letting go. It's actually an experiential.
Yeah, that's precisely why the Buddha gave us a framework for practice. Because if starting from the standpoint of ignorance, we have nothing to go by. Mm-hmm. But when we bring that ignorance within that framework of the Eightfold Path, and we look at our thoughts, words, and deeds in relationship to right view, etc., that begins to shine the light of wisdom on it. The first two factors of the Eightfold Path are called the wisdom factors for a reason. It begins to bring wisdom into our awareness, into our mindfulness. It shines the light of wisdom onto that ignorance that we had before we engaged into that framework. It's why I constantly come back to our Dhamma practices within that framework. It's not just a meditation practice. You know, it's not just anything else.
What are those first two factors
then? Right view and right intention are the wisdom factors. So there's the Eightfold Path is usually classified as a path of wisdom, virtue, and concentration. The first two factors are right view and right intention. The virtuous factors, right speech, right intention, right livelihood, not right action and right livelihood. And the last three are the concentration factors, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. You know, wisdom, virtue, and concentration. The initial wisdom is just the hook. We come across the Four Noble Truths, and there's something there that grabs our attention. Or it might just be the suffering in our lives, or the confusion, and we say, well, there's got to be something else. Let me start looking at it. We look at different things, and we come across Buddhism, and we come across all the aspects of Buddhism, and then we kind of fine-tune it. We get down to what the Buddha actually taught. And that makes sense to us. It makes an initial sense, a mundane sense. That's the beginning of right view. Super mundane right view is the awakened mind. It starts from that initial mundane right view, and it ends from that same point with deep understanding of the reality of life. The second factor, the second wisdom factor, is right intention. It takes great wisdom to understand that in order for me to awaken to who I truly am, to put aside all the shackles of dukkha, begins with emptying myself of clinging. So you see how those are the wisdom factors, why they're called that? It takes wisdom to enter, and the first step on the path is beginning to abandon clinging. It's very simple and direct. The concepts are so contrary to what an ego personality wants to maintain. That's why we have such a difficult time in integrating them. You know, we just don't want to accept it. And so anxiety can arise. That's why I always say be gentle with yourself, because this is a difficult path at times. As we continue the process and as we begin to understand what it is that's impacted by this impermanent, insubstantial self, it becomes easier to let go of. We don't want to defend ourselves so much anymore. I say this often, what Lao Tzu said, once you realize the impermanence of all things, this ego personality, you let go of everything. Why would you hang on to it? Why would you put the extreme effort that we put ourselves through to maintain this thing that suffers? Let it go and live a human life, fully awakened human life, right in this present moment. Awakening does not occur in the future. It can't. It occurs right here, right now. Usually it's gradual. You know, when the Buddha characterizes the path to awakening, let me preface it this way. When the Buddha gave his first talk, the Dhammakakapavattana Sutta, setting the wheel of truth, I love to say that, setting the wheel of truth in motion, was to the five wandering buddies that he had for the few years that he was walking around northern India. He had awakened, and he sat for 2 weeks about trying to figure out how to present this and should he even bother to present it? Could human beings understand this? And how to present it in a way that was understandable? And he had decided, there's all kinds of legends about what happened and gods and goddesses come to try to convince him, but it was in his own mind that he realized that this is something that's worthwhile and that human beings can understand. About 2 weeks later, these five buddies come walking down the road and they see the Buddha sitting there in complete bliss. And it was obvious that he had attained the awakened state, that he was now a Buddha. But they had decided that because he rejected their talks, their way of, he rejected their Dhamma, that they were going to ignore him. They didn't want anything to do with the Buddha. They want to give him credence. And they tried to walk by the Buddha. But one of the, I don't remember which one it was, it might have been Khandana, saw the Buddha and saw the way he was and said, we gotta see what this guy's got. And they sat down, they listened to him. And the Buddha gave that sutta on the Four Noble Truths in a very simple way that is the only way to really present it. It wasn't a long talk. And Khandana, I think, and I believe it was him, awakened instantly at the end of hearing that five-minute talk. The other four didn't get it completely. The next day, the Buddha gave the talk on non-self, and those four awakened. It's the same Dhamma that we have today. And I'm not disparaging myself because some people take a little bit more than two talks of mine to awaken. The point is that it's the same Dhamma. We can all awaken in the present moment. It may be that we have more conditioned mind. It may, you know, if you believe in physical reincarnation, we've had 25 years to add on to that. Maybe not. It may be that we live in a little bit more confusing time, a more distracting time. But no matter what, the Dhamma still prevails, and each one of us can waken in this present moment. So I'm not going to get all, I won't use the word. I won't say that you're awakened now, you just don't know it, because that's not true. It's not true. We like to say that. We like to say that, and it's true that there's an aspect of us that knows the truth, but you don't have it yet. That's what that ignorance points to. Ignorance means a lack of wisdom. So again, this practice shines a light of wisdom on our own ignorance. We can't look at that awful word ignorance and not have a reaction to it until we realize it just describes the condition, that's all. You know, you're not ignorant to the point where you can't do your job or be a good parent or a good, you know, a good spouse. Doesn't mean that. It just means you're ignorant of the truth of the Dhamma, that's all. So don't take it any further than that. Okay. So please interrupt me. Having arisen within impermanence, the ego self has the characteristics of impermanence. Everything we think about ourselves changes moment by moment. We've probably, every one of us has changed quite a bit since we got here Thursday, I would bet. You know? You'll continue to change more before you leave here. When you leave here, even if you say, I have nothing to do with the Dhamma anymore. It's just a lot of nonsense. I wasted 4 days. You're going to change. No matter what. Something's going to happen. It's going to change you. It's either going to change you to more conditioned thinking or it's going to change you towards awakening. And that's where mindfulness comes in. Are we going to be mindful of awakening in this present moment? Or are we going to disregard what we now know is the truth and continue conditioned thinking? And we'll get into karma and rebirth, but then continue to further karma. You know, karma is impersonal. It's not good or bad. It's impersonal. Non-self is what is subject to the distraction of dukkha, perpetuating delusion. Impermanence also allows for the ego self to be extinguished and the distraction of stress brought to an end. Views of self leading to suffering are formed due to a lack of understanding due to ignorance. Developing understanding, developing wisdom, ends unhappiness and stress, the path of wisdom. It is clinging that perpetuates the ego self. It is the ego personality's preoccupation with stress or dukkha, preoccupation with dukkha, that perpetuates clinging and continues disenchantment and unhappiness. So that environment, anicca, dukkha, and non-self, it's all intertwined. Within that environment, we become so distracted and preoccupied with dukkha that we can do nothing else but continue it. Right? We almost don't have the choice unless we bring some mindfulness to this, unless we're able to see what's going on, to see that it's by our own thoughts, words, and deeds that we're perpetuating dukkha. Or else we just perpetuate dukkha. We just continue with it. Endlessly. You know, there's no magic to the Dhamma. There's nothing that says everybody has to receive the Dhamma at some point. There's no overarching law that says if you just hang around long enough, you'll hear the Dhamma. This is a precious teaching that a human being came to. Not everyone hears it. Not everyone's ready to hear it. I'm not saying there's anything special about any of us or people that awaken. That's a wrong way of looking at it. But the right way of looking at it is, it's here. I got to make the best of it. And that's the way I see it. When I think about the circumstances in the world at the time of the Buddha, and what he did to awaken, and that the exact same Dhamma, and even, I probably won't get to the chance to talk about how the Pali Canon has preserved these, but if you get a chance, go online and read that article. It's amazing that what I'm saying is almost exactly the same thing as the Buddha said 2,500 years ago. One of the reasons why I'm able to say it is because it's so uncomplicated. It's so simple and it's so direct. You know? But it's amazing to me that it's still here. You know, that we're here on October the 3rd, 2014, listening to it, talking about it, contemplating it, using it to awaken. That's the lineage of the Dhamma. That's a true lineage. From the words of the Buddha, a human being, the Dhamma has been passed through each mind that has been able to access it and understand it. And here it is right now. That's astonishing to me. And that it works. It's passed through 2,500 years of impermanence and uncertainty. And here it is. It's a pretty amazing Dhamma to be able to do that. For the first at least 100 years, probably more like 500 years, it wasn't even written down. It was memorized, and it was taught in a repetitive fashion. That's why the Pali Canon is very, very repetitive. That's why it's hard to read. It was taught in a repetitive fashion so that nothing was left out. You know, the same thing was said over and over again, much like I do it, but not for the same reason. And that Dhamma is still here today. Buddhist chant originated with the intent of maintaining the Dhamma, not so much that there was specialness to chanting, although chanting the Dhamma certainly is special, but it was a way of memorizing the Dhamma and making sure nothing was left out, and it's prevailed. Where was I? It is within the environment of impermanence that stress arises and all wrong views of self are established and maintained. And so, it means that they can all be let go of. They've all arisen. These wrong views that we've had have arisen within impermanence. That's a prevailing condition. and it can be let go of just as easily. There's no reason to not. They're all impermanent. It is also within the environment of impermanence that awakening occurs. What is awakening? I read this morning. The Buddha describes awakening simply and directly, without any ambiguity, esoterica, or magical thinking. Awakening is understanding stress, abandoning the cause of stress, which is clinging, excuse me, Maura, experiencing the cessation of stress, and developing the path leading to the cessation of stress. That's awakening. You know, I know I've said that two or three times today, but that's awakening. It's nothing else. Understanding impermanence brings an end to all clinging views. Why would we, like Lao Tzu said, why would we hold on to something that we know is insubstantial and impermanent and let it go? As the way of understanding the environment of impermanence and clinging, the Buddha taught Four Noble Truths. The development and understanding of the Four Noble Truths occurs within the environment of impermanence. We don't need to go anywhere else. We don't have to be anything special. We stay right here where we are, right where dukkha is unfolding, right where karma is unfolding is where awakening occurs, by recognizing it, by being able to maintain our present moment mindfulness within an ever-changing world. You know, and that's part of the difficulty, you know, the uncertainty and the distraction of things happening, and to keep our minds here in the present moment where awakening occurs. Through understanding the environment in which the ego self is established and maintained, all views of self can be recognized. Through recognition and right intention, all views of self can be abandoned. The Eightfold Path develops understanding known as right view. Right view is understanding the truth of stress and the impermanent environment that the ego self is established and maintained. The sole purpose of the Dhamma is to recognize and abandon all clinging views of an ego self. That goes back to that one paragraph on awakening that we talked about yesterday, I guess it was. Now I don't remember. Abandoning all clinging views of body, feeling, perception, fabrication, and consciousness. Abandoning all clinging of those five groups. Impermanent stress in the ego self are all observable facts of our human existence. The reason why the Buddha singled out anicca, dukkha, and anatta is because they're right in front of us. We can see them. We can understand them. He's not teaching anything magical or mystical. Everything we can see, everything we can experience, we know we ourselves are impermanent. But everything else, scientists have proven that at some point the universe is going to poof, like the Tibetan monk thing. There's nothing we can look at or hold on to or wish is permanent. Why hold on to it? Including this unfolding moment by moment awakening is impermanent. At some point the impermanence will set in and awakening will occur. That change will take place. Let me get too far and get through some of this. Impermanence is the pervasive, overarching experience of all life in the phenomenal world. By clinging to form of an ego self, I won't get into nama rupa. Stress is experienced within the environment of impermanence through perception and feeling. The ego personality establishes and maintains itself by clinging to impermanent objects and experiences. It is the ego personality, I have a trouble with that word, personality, that is subject to unhappiness and stress. While I was reading that, I was thinking about Denise and the healing bowls, and how that has, Matt may want to comment on this too. Matt will understand this. The Buddha talked about everything arising from these things called kalapas, K-A-L-A-P-A-S. And what he's describing are something that scientists are just now getting a little understanding of. He's talking about subatomic particles that come into existence and go out of existence, in his words, in a blink of an eye. And it's these kalapas that make up who we are and everything else we experience in the phenomenal world. That in itself is a teaching in Nietzsche. These things that make us up come into and go out of existence in the blink of an eye. We can't even recognize it. I don't want to use the word true. Authentic energy work, the bowls put into motion by someone who understands, begins the process of unraveling those things that we're holding on to the most. You know, that's why it's effective. or it's one reason. I'll let Denise explain, if you want to, why you, your perspective. The Qigong or anything in that matter is so helpful and supportive of the Dhamma because it starts loosening up that grip that we have on things, that this physical body is holding on to. I heard a little bit of what Matt was describing before. You know, these things get stuck in our body. Where else would they be? It's not our there's six senses plus the, there's five senses plus the sixth consciousness. So it's occurring here. Everything that we're experiencing is occurring in this impermanent thing. That's why we can't
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.